Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 1283.PR2433, certificate number 24398, the Teddy Bear Shipwreck.
Mom, Dad, guess what? My teddy bear's alive!
Really? Well, isn't that exciting?
No, Mom, he's really alive. Look!
Merry Christmas, everybody!
Aww.
You were happy for a second.
The teddy bear shipwreck?
Shipwreck. Yeah, the teddy bear picnic ended in tragedy this year.
No, the teddy bear shipwreck. Well, you know what? You shouldn't let teddy bears have a ship. That's the first mistake.
Do you feel like they were probably... They weren't captaining the ship, don't worry.
Oh, they weren't?
No. They were in a cargo hold.
Oh.
I recently saw a survey conducted, as it turned out, by the not disinterested Build-A-Bear Workshop. To the effect that 34% of American adults sleep with a stuffed animal.
Come on.
Do you believe it?
Come on.
One in three?
No. No.
Because you think it's higher?
Listen, I have my childhood teddy bear.
You do?
Whose name is Teddy.
Nice.
It was the 60s. You know, we weren't creative.
You were a teddy boy.
I've never been a very brand-oriented. Like, my mom and sister both name their cars.
Well, you're an artist, though. You're imaginative. You're not like, this is Wendell Wonderland. He lives under a tree in the Forest of Dreams.
No, that's not me at all. My mom names her cars based on their color. Like, there's Reddy, and then there was Whitey, and then there was
I think I see where your naming creativity comes from.
And my sister names her cars, but, like, she had one called Soggy Doggy. She had, you know, she's got names for her cars. And I just call it like the truck, the blue one. And the blue one, even people yell at me because it's actually green.
You rarely need to name your car because you can always say, you know, cars always come with a brand, a model, a make. You can always say, are we taking the truck?
Yeah.
Are we taking the Volvo? Are we taking the Focus? You could say any of those things.
Yeah. But my Teddy's name is Teddy. And Teddy, I've had all along. Teddy is very threadbare, and Teddy sits on the shelf. He watches me sleep.
So he is in your bedroom.
He's in the bedroom, but he is not in the bed. Well, how ridiculous.
I'm not a sicko.
What the hell?
Well, I wonder how the question was phrased. What if the Build-A-Bear could have asked in such a way that you're like, yes, my childhood teddy bear is in my bedroom every night. I guess I'm a yes.
I guess.
It turned out to be generational. You will be shocked to hear that maybe we are a little old to understand our peers all sleeping with their...
I suppose.
Teddy bears? Does this tie in with your narrative about everyone younger than you being a checked out child adult?
Mm. I mean, I think that
the millennials do outstrip any other generation in,
of course,
adult teddy bear usage.
I have my teddy bear and have had my teddy bear continuously. It's not like Teddy spent 30 years in a box.
Yeah.
Teddy Bear has been with me the whole time.
Bear, comma, Teddy.
And Teddy used to have a music box in him, but it's
really
an old-fashioned music box.
It had a drum with the little tinkle-tinkle things.
For sure, it, like, embedded inside, and a crank. And then it would play...
What did it play?
A little song, I don't know.
Lullaby,
some lullaby
goodnight.
Song. And the little box hasn't worked in a long time.
That's bad. That'll never play long enough to get the kid to sleep.
No. It was too short.
It's bad technology.
But I haven't used the Bear to go to sleep since I was 5 or 6.
Why do you think a plurality of millennials do?
Well, because there was an explosion in stuffed animals. I think that
China coming online?
Yeah, maybe Beanie Babies. I mean, I
guess
think
we talked about this
when
in
we
Beanie
were
Babies
kids
entry.
In the Sears catalog, there were 9 stuffed animals you could get. And probably in 1968, you went into an old fashioned toy store with a gray haired, Geppetto type person, and you picked a bear that had a ribbon,
had buttons for eyes,
and they wrapped it in tissue paper. Like, I don't think you could get a stuffed animal at every single grocery store and whatnot.
I think I might have had a preview of the millennial childhood then, because when we moved to Korea, there were either really nice stuffed animals or knockoff stuffed animals for sale on the street everywhere pennies on the dollar, just from carts, either because they were making them there and these were factory seconds, or they were knockoffs, or they fell off the back of a truck. Or
when you were a kid, there must have been a Korean fascination with Japan, complicated fascination with Japan.
Yeah, they're a little bit anti-Japan, as they are today.
But also fascinated, right? Like Japanese pop stars.
Maybe. I moved there before, not just before the birth of Korean culture, K-pop and everything else, but also before the Korean economic miracle. So it was still a developing nation and a military dictatorship when I lived there.
Because it does feel like stuffed animals as a lifestyle has a Japanese root.
Oh, I see.
And then the millennials are the ones that had childhoods that most had sort of an anime.
Are they all sleeping with Snorlax and Pikachu?
Probably now it's all waifu pillows.
That doesn't count as a stuffed animal, does it?
Doesn't it?
I'd have to read what I can't imagine Build-A-Bear Workshop wants their name on a poll that reveals how many millennials are sleeping with a waifu or a husabando.
Well, what's interesting is that my sheets that are on my bed right now, of course, are the sheets that sponsor Omnibus.
Miracle Made.
But in addition to those, there's another set of, pillowcases that are vintage pillowcases designed by Peter Max.
Those are not your childhood. As a kid, you did not have Peter Max pillowcases, I'm going to guess.
But I did have pillowcases that had big rainbows on them because nice. Rainbow culture.
Because you're a good ally.
Uh-huh. And the Peter Max pillowcases do have rainbow coloring, and I also have a rainbow pillowcase.
Nice.
So
it's okay to have a gay bed.
I cuddle my rainbow pillow every night.
Well, that's the thing. The cuddling seems important. You know, the Atlantic has referred to this as kid-dulthood, this idea that the maturity of adulthood is not just the maturities of adulthood are getting pushed back, or the kids today don't know how to X, but more like adults today are more comfortable retaining the comforting things about their childhood that they miss. I remember I was as young as maybe 3rd or 4th grade, and my little sister just had a bedroom, like an ET closet full of just hundreds of stuffed animals, because you could get these high-end Gund and Steiff stuffed animals knockoffs on the streets of Seoul. So she just had 100.
Now, wait, I think my sister did too.
And I loved this stuff. And I was like, oh, we can have I wasn't like having tea parties, but like, okay, we can tell a story. Like, this bear could be related to that bear, and these two raccoons could be siblings. And, so I was telling
narratives.
I was telling stories, but I knew that if my friends at school found out that I was playing with my sister's stuffed horses, that I knew that was embarrassing. And that sense has gone away, which is nice. You can enjoy your plushie without worrying about that it's, there's a stigma.
Well, this is our contemporary thinking that is nice because there's no longer a stigma. But there's also another argument that, like, well, when you become a grown up, you put aside childish things.
Well, the thing about stuffed animals is, here's the defense of stuffed animals. These people are not holding it under their arm as they go to work or game. Like, you will see those guys at an anime convention.
Sure.
But for the most part, I think the teddy bear lives in the bed, and it's just like, that's the thing that they can, it's their routine that helps them sleep, because I think we're more aware than any other generation how, like, sleep divides us into people who are functioning and people who are not. And whatever it takes to sleep, that's the thing you do.
Although, arguably, the people that don't sleep are also the ones that are developing apps or whatever. I mean, there's functioning and there's functioning.
Well, that's just because of the Adderall they're taking.
I don't know if we've discussed this, but my daughter is a member of a swim team, and I go to the swim meets. And I've noticed in her cadre something that I would characterize as a complete disinterest in growing up. It's not that they particularly love their childhood as much as it is that adulthood as it's presented to them has absolutely nothing to recommend it.
We're not doing a good job of selling adulthood.
No.
Who is the Don Draper of adulthood?
And in my childhood, adults had mysterious lives where they were part of a mysterious culture that children weren't invited to and weren't included in.
But were you like me? Were you aware that it seemed like a bummer? I was like, these guys have, like, maybe some kids are like, they have cars and jobs. And I was very much the first Gen Zer who was like, ew, they have cars and jobs.
Well, no, I think I was, because cities were fascinating. And as a child, you were in a city just as a, you were just a cucaracha in a city, like you were in the way of grown-ups who were in suits and ties and hats, and they were all going places. And I did go with my dad to office buildings and government buildings, and it all seemed mysterious and kind of fantastic.
It seemed boring to me. it seemed boring.
You know, my dad wasn't boring, right? He was an interesting man. And
you're saying my dad is boring?
Well, no. I mean, both your dad and my dad were lawyers.
But he must not have done a good job of selling the glamour of the adult world. Maybe because he didn't smoke.
But also television, like, there were no, I mean, shows weren't for kids. There were cartoons on Saturday morning for kids.
True.
But all other shows showed adults doing adult things. And I notice now, I go to these swim meets and I see all these parents, most of whom are millennials. And they're dressed like children. The dads are all in board shorts and trainers with their hats on backwards. And you know, you can just tell by looking at them that what they do is game. They go home and they have game stations.
They all know what Harry Potter house they are.
And their kids also know what Harry Potter house they are, and the kids also game. And so the parents and the kids have the same culture. Which is, I mean, my dad did not share a single cultural, nothing he did overlapped with what I did. I did kid things, he did grown-up things. And so looking at my kid and her friends and realizing that adulthood has no attraction for them, because it seems like adults just do the same thing they do, except their lives are lame. Like they have stress and they
That's
have...
That's what, I mean, I think it's the second thing that I noticed.
Yeah.
They had a lot less freedom than I did, and it was very clear.
But they did have freedom. There were so many places they could go that we couldn't.
But they're complaining about bills, and they had to make dinner, and I didn't. I think even as a kid, I knew I had it pretty damn easy.
But did you want to stay there?
I mean, on some ways, yes, some ways, no. Like, I was not like the kids today who, like, I think a lot of my son's cohorts don't have their driver's licenses.
I mean, I think the difference is that you knew you couldn't stay there.
Right. It wasn't an option, but boy.
Maybe you dreaded adulthood, but you knew you had to go.
Right.
And now I think that a lot of them don't see that there's much difference. Like there are no additional privileges. There are only duties. But what you do when you want to relax is come home and game and
do kid stuff
and hug your teddy bear and wear kid clothes.
Whereas
and,
at least I could imagine adults drinking martinis and
smoking cigarettes, going
to the Copa.
But I think we have presented that in recent years as some kind of revolution in acceptance, and we're living in an enlightened time because we don't shame each other for sleeping with a teddy bear. What was the term?
Kidulthood. It's not good.
Like, that doesn't sound that great when you, I mean, on the short, you're like, oh, it's great that we don't.
I mean, if they never get an index fund or learn how to grocery shop, yeah.
Well, the millennials will inherit all their boomer parents' wealth, and then all of a sudden all this protest we've been experiencing for the last 10 years will evaporate in an hour when they're like, oh, wait, I'm actually a millionaire now. Better stop being a socialist.
Did you did your kid have a beloved toy? Did it survive?
So we found these little rabbits that didn't have bodies. It was a rabbit head.
Just the idea of a rabbit? Oh, it had a head.
The rabbit head and rabbit arms. But then the rest of it was kind of a blankie.
I thought it didn't have a body, like it was a non-corporeal entity.
Yeah, it was just like a fantasy
of a
rabbit.
You just bought the concept of a rabbit.
I just held up a picture of a rabbit and was like, cuddle this. No, it was a head and arms. And then the rest of it was kind of a flowing little, not a handkerchief, although kind of handkerchief sized.
Right.
But it was made out of fuzzy, silky.
I can picture this.
Yeah. And I at first was like, why doesn't the rabbit have a body? Like, this isn't that great.
It's a ghost.
But she really liked ribbons because she would kind of caress them, little ribbons. And the rabbit had a ribbon, and then it also had a tag down in the handkerchief. And so she would caress these tags when she sucked her thumb. And the original bunny was called Bed Bunny. And then in order not to lose Bed Bunny, we bought Car Bunny.
Mm.
And Car Bunny lived in the car and Bed Bunny lived in the bed.
I just made the same discovery with sunglasses. I'm a few years behind you in technology.
That's right. Car sunglasses need to stay in the car.
So you never lost Car Bunny or Bed Bunny?
Well, then my mom wanted a bunny for her house and she found some toy in a thrift store that...
Oh.
It was like a bunny adjacent.
Kids will not accept off-brand version.
Except this was Nana toy.
So it was special.
And then someone bought me a bed bunny for my house. And so then there was another bunny, Dad Bunny. And then I had a...
This is too much, too big a lore drop.
I had a Car Bunny in my car. So there were all these bunnies, but they were all the same bunny. Except for my mom's toy, which was some crazy toy. But we had these bunnies, and you can tell which bunny is which by the wear.
Yes.
So her bed bunny, original bed bunny, is just complete. There are no eyes left. It's just a complete disaster.
Is Bed Bunny in bed right now?
Bed Bunny is upstairs in, if not in bed, yeah, I think it might even still be floating around in bed. And then the other bunnies have gone into, you know, keepsake boxes and... You know, I, of course, want Dad Bunny to be in my little... It's like everybody gets their own reward bunny. Well, this might not have been number one bunny, but I definitely had number four bunny.
It's like being a Microsoft stockholder.
Well, you know, she used to, when she was old enough to write, she would make lists of everybody in her family according to who she liked best. And I was always like either last or second to last, but like before or after the cat.
Were the bunnies on the list or did they count as one person or?
No, it was always like, well, it was either Nana is at the top or Granddad is at the top. And then, you know, Mom is like second or third. And then, yeah, there were all kinds of things.
Maybe because you were always like, adulthood is its own world. I share no interest with you.
Yeah, it was like cucumbers and, you know, other things like house keys. And then it was Dad at the end. It was always, you know, she wanted me to understand.
It's funny that you mentioned the different versions because my kids, for some reason, just through, I think, more accident than design, both latched onto like IKEA toys.
Oh, yeah, I know
IKEA
some of
usually
those.
Has 6 to 8 different kinds of stuffed animals for some reason.
And which one did they like?
My older kid had a bear, which was called Blund, I think.
Blund.
And so he loved Blund. And then my young
blonde bear.
I think that's probably what it is. Yeah. And then my younger kid had a rabbit that was supposed to be called Minnenkanen.
Yeah.
But, we just all called the bunny Hop.
Hop.
And it was the same thing. There were multiples of each of them because you could always replace them.
Yeah.
I think neither one is for sale now, but a lot of people are nostalgia buying them on eBay, but we bought in bulk just in case we needed
smart
Car Bunny or whatever. And it turned out to be true. Blund got left on a flight once and I ran back through O'Hare trying to see if I could get it off the first plane during a layover and I couldn't. And we had to go to some backup Blund, but it was a slightly different color. The nose, the muzzle looked a little different. So
Did Blonde 2 get accepted?
Eventually, but it was never quite as good. And of course, it doesn't smell like the kid's saliva or whatever, yeah, right. Like the thing they've been sucking on for 18 months.
I mean, that's the thing about Real Bed Bunny. Real Bed Bunny is just like, look, just dragged through the dirt.
And then when Hop got replaced, my kid never liked it and ended up calling them Happy Hop and Sad Hop.
Oh.
Because there was clearly a good one.
Oh.
And a bad one.
Happy Hop and Sad Hop.
But we, you know, we deposit a lot of our, you know, they're totemic, these childhood symbols, whether it's a blanket or a, whatever your special thing was.
Yeah.
I think I had a mouse when I was a kid.
Oh, you don't still have your little friend?
I think it might be in tatters in a box somewhere. But the last time I saw it, it literally was like,
yeah,
like a fragment of the true cross. Like it was like a, yeah, little patch of what now looked like Phoenician burlap or something.
I don't know why, but the idea that you had a stuffed mouse really works for
Does
me.
It?
I look at you and I go,
mouse
stuffed
guy,
mouse.
Mouse guy.
Yeah, like Fievel or something.
It
right?
does make you, I can't, all I've seen is the decrepit scrap. I can't even picture the real guy. It does make you wonder who you would be if you've been given a different, you know, if somebody had given me a stallion, who knows?
I think the difference in our ages might be that there were only teddy bears,
yeah,
available to me. I think a lot of my sister's closet of stuffed animals came from the county fair. Somebody would knock over a bunch of milk bottles and she'd get some coyote.
We never had that, Victor. I never thought about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, stuffed animals are a surprisingly modern innovation. You know, they are, you know, for hundreds of years, you know, we can find in prehistoric civilization what little pieces of wood or bone the kids were spinning or flipping or using as a ball.
After the arrival of the sea people and all the civilization collapses, it's going to be back to bone and,
yeah, start playing with little
dice,
a wood made of corn, a doll made of a corn cob. Now there were, you know, so there were kites and little soldiers and stuff, but you know, you imagine these cool old timey toys, the rocking horse and the giant dollhouse and, you know, you're kind of overlooking the fact that those were all for the very rich.
And that's Victoriana too, right?
Yeah, and that's, you know, 150 years ago. And that stuff's not, that they maybe weren't allowed to play with their stuff too because it was too nice.
Oh, right. It's like the dad that won't let you play with the Lego.
Exactly. You
funny
know,
to think that Venus of Willendorf might actually be a child's,
what kind
like
of
little mom?
What kind of messed up toy was that?
It's not actually a fertility symbol. It's actually just a kid's toy.
I just
toy.
Need to rub these breasts and genitalia or I can't nod off. You know, and less affluent kids would have little rag dolls, but that was really the only kind of soft toy.
Hmm.
The idea of a stuffed toy, you know, they were around, but they were kind of individually made the way your mom might improvise a rag doll,
right,
for you. You know, it might be cotton or even leather, but it would be stuffed with something that just sucked, you know, like sawdust or, you know, a horse hair at best.
Why are you so against sawdust?
Do you think it's fun to play with sawdust?
I mean, it was a major export of the Pacific Northwest for our whole lives.
I feel like you're implying it's unpatriotic for me to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right.
Imagine hugging your favorite stuffed animal. Now imagine it's full of sawdust. Kind of, it's not there anymore, right?
Have you ever slept on a mattress made of straw or filled with straw?
No, but it must poke through the cloth.
It sucks. It really sucks.
Ticking?
Horsehair too.
Yeah, exactly.
It sucks.
But you know, horsehair was what was in all that nice Louis XIV furniture you see, yeah, in palaces.
Right.
Because better stuffings had not yet been invented.
Better stuffings.
But the idea that there would be goods, especially for children, that would be sold, bought and sold, and would not just be, you know, something your mom might make you for a baby when you were a baby, that started to grow as the idea of childhood began to appear. Child labor laws,
right,
started to go away in the 19th century, and at the same time, we were like, well, instead of treating them like very little workers that can reach the inside part of the loom when it jams, like, you know, what if they have their own, what if they're their own kind of species? And that's when kids started to get more toys and things that were just for them.
You know what it was? It was when armies stopped needing fife players.
That's what you would do with your kid?
Little drummer boys and fife players. It's what it was, your whole child economy.
You're 7 years old. Time to go to Antietam. The very first commercially available, the commercially made and marketed stuffed animal appears to be a felt elephant. A German woman named Margareta Steiff.
A felt elephant.
You wouldn't start with a felophant?
No, I might. You now that you think about it.
She'd been stricken by polio, which meant I think she didn't have very good mobility and maybe only the use of one of her arms. But despite that fact, she became a seamstress, heroically overcoming her disability, and was successful enough, was a skilled enough sewer and tailor that she could open up her own clothing store. And to that end, she got magazines or, you know, publications that had patterns. Do we still live in pattern world?
Sure.
Like Etsy people still go buy patterns?
Sure they do.
I remember, like, my mom would never buy a nice dress, but she would go down to the mall and buy a pattern.
Yeah, well, and then the fabric, and it goes like...
Right. So Margareta would buy books from all over the world with different clothing patterns, things she could offer to her customers or sell in her shop. And in an 1888, I think, edition of Delineator magazine, an American fashion pattern magazine.
Oh, it wasn't just about delineating between any kind of two things?
Today it does sound like it's The Economist or something.
Yeah.
Oh, I read The Delineator.
Well,
I have opinions about the trade embargo.
We were going to... You know, Omnibus was originally going to be called The Worst, and we were going to delineate what the worst thing of anything was.
This show is still The Delineator. Except I think it's fine for these child men to sleep with their teddy bears, and you're like, boo.
Yeah, or at least, you know, like, let's look more deeply into this. I'm definitely in favor of people becoming good seamstresses when they only have one hand.
Sure.
I mean, that's kind of the Django Reinhardt story of seams.
She was the Django Reinhardt of felt elephants. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody agreed.
Mm-hmm.
But in this magazine, in the Delineator, along with the dresses, there was kind of a novelty, a little tiny felt elephant you could make. And I think it was intended to be a pincushion.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because that was Margareta's idea. You know, they had the ones that looked like tomatoes or whatever.
Yeah, no, we had one, a tomato.
Right. Well, in this case, new technology. What if it's an elephant you have to stick pins in?
It does feel like my childhood. Here, kid, play with this pin cushion.
Well, there really weren't a lot of, there weren't cuddly toys. People played with tin soldiers and hard things like that.
Yeah.
But you don't want to go to sleep clutching a... tin soldier, you'll shoot your eye out. Is that your origin story?
I think a lot of kids, a lot of boy kids my age, did sleep with G.I. Joe, which would have been a kind of Barbie-like
hard
plastic.
Was it legal for G.I. Joe to sleep with children at the time? That's horrifying.
Well, you know, that's just a lot has changed.
I thought you were old enough that you had a cowboy hat and six shooter.
Oh,
since you're borderline,
I absolutely did
borderline
have
boomer
cap guns, but I didn't have those stupid boomer cowboy hats. I hated those things, the little flat brim red hats.
The funniest thing in the Toy Story movies is it's like a modern day 90s child who loves cowboys.
Yeah.
That thing that definitely exists and is not just John Lasseter's own childhood.
For sure. I still have two cap, and by cap, I mean paper rolls, not those little caps that came later, the ones that were kind of plastic, molded plastic.
Yeah, I remember the...
paper rolls.
Well, in the individual ones where it's like kind of tied like a little sugar cube?
No.
Oh.
They were long rolls like a typewriter ribbon, and they were made of red paper.
Oh, no.
And then inside there were little capsules of gunpowder, and you could unroll them and hit them with a hammer and make like pow, pow, pow. But you put them in a cap gun, and you rolled it... and then the hammer would come down on the cap, and it would explode and make a big puff of smoke.
Pop and advance or not?
And then advance. So when you were shooting your cap gun, this piece of red paper tape would
like a receipt, like a CVS receipt.
Yeah, exactly, would gradually come up out of the gun, and you could, you know, rip them off or whatever. But
okay, but, boomer.
But you know, the rolls had like 30 caps on them, so completely unrealistic.
Those were better than those little plastic rings. They never had 30.
Yeah, that
shots.
Those were always 8 or 10.
Yeah. Anyway, Margareta's elephant.
I mean, anyway, that's the real story. Anyway,
if we can get John to stop talking about cap guns, a thing that really happened with no provocation. She made this elephant pincushion, but she'd also been in the habit of giving, you know, sewing little toys for friends when they would have babies.
Oh.
And the elephant pincushion became a big hit when repurposed as a baby toy.
Oh.
And when her business got big enough that she started to consider actually having a factory that would mass produce her stitched items. One of the things that it produced in 1893 was a mass produced version of that little felt elephant.
What, really?
Because upholstery technology had changed, I guess. Like, furniture was no longer handcrafted by Geppetto. Like, now there were, I'm not going to say I know what they are, but faster and more industrialized machine stitched ways produce upholstered furniture.
Right.
And you could use those same techniques and machines and operators, I guess, to speed up sewn and stuffed anything. It doesn't have to be a chair front or a couch cushion.
So the sewing machine really became a thing in 1830. So yeah, it was probably really expensive at first, and then became a tool.
Yeah, it started to
mass production.
Right. And so that's pretty landmark. That's a landmark thing that she has a factory that is making a stuffed toy in 1893. The first U.S. stuffed animal fad had happened the previous year in 1892. An odd thing called the Ithaca Kitty, which is not the sex move it sounds like, but is in fact the soggy doggy, the Ithaca Kitty. It's a very odd stuffed animal because it's actually a photorealistic picture of a tabby cat. If I remember right, it was based on a photograph that had been taken of the owner's cat, with the one exception that their cat had polydactyly. They had the extra claw.
Oh.
And they thought that would be upsetting, so they doctored the photo to have the normal number of cat claws.
And how is the photo turned into a stuffed animal?
It's printed on a sheet of muslin, and which is then, you know, so it's almost like a cushion with a picture of a cat on it, but it's vaguely cat-shaped.
Like a Kewpie doll.
Yes. It kind of looks like a very old video game where a picture of a cat has been rendered over a vaguely cat-shaped blob.
Yeah.
So there's something a little bit off-putting about it.
Do you think anyone younger than us knows what a Kewpie doll is?
Do they still have them at carnivals? No, right? Kids are just winning Pikachus?
No, what are those things called? Punks. What is a thing that you throw a baseball at a carnival? It's got a name like that, like punk or...
I don't know carny slang.
Yeah, that's the thing. I really wanted to join the carnival when I was 10 years old.
We should do an omnibus on carnies. We have not yet. It's kind of this weird uncanny valley where it's almost an animal stuffed animal, but since they didn't have cute animal stuffed animals, they were like, oh my gosh, it's a cat and a pillow and a toy. And this was a huge fad.
It looks just like a cat.
It does kind of in a creepy, too realistic kind of engraved way.
Yeah.
It was a hit as everything on Omnibus eventually is at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
Yep.
Became a mass produced sensation.
My great grandmother performed at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
Was she like a fan dancer?
No. She sang opera.
Really?
Yeah. And got some kind of ribbon.
Very nice.
Well,
do you think everybody got a ribbon back then?
Maybe no. That was the time before everybody got a ribbon.
Only
not
she
like
got a
days.
Ribbon.
The winners got ribbons, Ken, and the losers went home with nothing.
Do you know? I don't think there's any cultural memory of this, but into my lifetime, I feel like old people knew this poem about the calico cat fighting the gingham dog.
Hmm.
Do you have any memory of this grandma verse?
Mm-mm. Calico cat fighting the gingham dog.
Yeah, and the idea is two little. Two stuffed animals are having a fight the way a real cat and a dog would. It was inspired by seeing, I think it might be Eugene Field, the same guy that wrote Winkin, Blinkin, and Nod. Speaking of grandma poetry we don't have anymore.
I also don't know Winkin, Blinkin, and Nod. That sounds like a law firm.
Winkin, Blinkin, and Nod, attorneys at law. We fight for you. We fight.
In an accident?
Clap for you. Yeah. Have you received a structured settlement that's not yet paid out? So this was a big fad in the U.S., but you'll notice this is an elephant, this is a cat. Nobody has tried to make a bear. And that all ends with, you know, one
our
of
hero.
The most famous stories, something maybe we have touched on the podcast before. The non-shot heard around the world is fired in November 1902 by no less than sitting president Theodore Roosevelt. He is visiting Mississippi, weirdly, to do something presidents don't do that much anymore. He is nominally...
Kill a bunch of people?
He is...
with a bow and arrow?
No, he's got a secret family down there.
Oh, yeah.
No, he's refereeing a border dispute between Mississippi and Louisiana. We could do a whole show about this. When the Mississippi River changes, it isolates little enclaves of one state. And the people there, even though they're on the wrong side of the river now, they keep paying taxes to the old state, and it's a whole thing.
I feel like a lot of that stuff's been resolved by the Corps of Engineers.
And by Teddy Roosevelt.
So this was the last time that a president went down and was like, all right, I hereby declare this sandbar belongs to Alabama.
This looks more like Alabama. I mean, maybe if flooding's going to be on the rise, we're going to have to see more of presidents adjudicating of river flooding territorial disputes. But anyway, really, it seems to be an excuse to do some good old Mississippi hound hunting. We know President Roosevelt loved to hunt.
What are you chasing down in Mississippi?
Maybe possums?
Yeah.
I mean, hounds chase raccoons, raccoon dogs.
But why do you want a possum?
Exactly. I mean, it's not the thrill of the chase if you're chasing something lethargic like an opossum.
But there are still bears in Mississippi, Alabama.
At the time, there, yes, and there still are, right? Or are there not?
Yeah, there are black bears.
There, at the time, were black bears in those woods, and Teddy Roosevelt, sorry, he did not like the name Teddy, interestingly.
Is that true?
Didn't like Teddy, thought it was derogatory.
Oh.
And thought it was not respectful.
Right, okay, if he's president.
But even, I guess he never liked it, and maybe it didn't become a nickname until he was president, and people wanted a cute thing to call him, like Ronnie Reagan. But he was intent on adding a black bear to his collection. And, you know, I think he has this reputation at the time, you know, that's still held up today by some of the hunting and conservation organizations he founded, that he was very interested in the fair chase being the important part of the hunt. You know, he didn't like these new commercial market hunting. You know, what we see today where dentists shoot a rhino or whatever.
No, you don't want to shoot wolves from a helicopter.
Exactly.
That's one of those things.
But he thought what was really fair and invigorating and why nature should be preserved is to shoot things close up one-on-one.
Hair, hair.
It's not really our universal modern understanding of conservation.
Yeah, it's the Francis McCumber story.
Right, that's right. But we did get there through that. You know, we kind of got to our modern place in conservation via a plurality of the public being like, yeah, we should protect the wilderness so I can go shoot things.
You know, you still see Ducks Unlimited stuff everywhere as a kind of, you know, sportsman's outdoor, like Ducks Unlimited. And what they mean is
there shouldn't be a
unlimited ducks so we can shoot the ducks.
Right. There should not be a limit on the number of ducks I can shoot that the state sets. Unfortunately, it doesn't work out according to the ideals of fair chase that President Roosevelt enjoys in his hunting. After the hounds have staked, have trailed a black bear all day, they haven't been able to catch up with it. And he's got a big hunting party, of course, and they've decided they're going to get the president a kill at any cost.
Time to get rid of those hounds, first of all.
Well, the hounds eventually do lead them to a black bear, but by the time the president hears about it, his coterie has already, like, trigger warning for animal violence, like clubbed the animal into like submission and then tied it to a tree.
Oh, this sounds like bullfighting.
Exactly. It becomes bear baiting or bullfighting or wolves from a helicopter, as you say in Alaska.
I know our bullfighting fan listeners are like, hey,
it's a beautiful art.
The bull is still very dangerous.
Mm.
Which seems not super true. Not after you put all those spears in it. Feels also the drugs, maybe.
Yeah, it's lost a lot of blood. And also they're fighting against an animal we domesticated 1,000 years ago, you know? Like if you were really such a brave man, wouldn't you be doing that kind of dance with a rhino?
I don't know. We domesticated human beings a long time ago. And if you tried to kill one with a sword, I think you'd have your hands full.
Anyway, President Roosevelt has shown this poor bear clubbed half to death and tied to a tree.
Boo.
And he refuses.
Yeah, he's got too much old-fashioned honor and dignity.
He does not think it's bully. In fact, no. He says, this isn't bully.
No, this is the opposite of bully.
I think in the version of this that's told in children's books, he agrees to let the cute, it's a cute little bear cub, and he agrees to let it go. What actually happened was it was a bloodied adult bear, and President Roosevelt said, somebody else put that guy out of his misery. And so the bear was shot anyway, but not by him.
No, is that right?
Yeah.
There wasn't a baby bear?
It was not a baby bear. The story that came to us came through Washington Post cartoonist Clifford Berryman, who had been doing a series of editorial cartoons about the president's visit to Mississippi. And because there was a border dispute, he had one. He did a cartoon called Drawing the Line in Mississippi. And he had originally done some with an adult bear that were closer to the stories that had come out of the hunt. But this time, he shows Teddy refusing to shoot a cute little bear cub. Get it? Drawing the line?
He draws the line at that.
It's a border dispute pun.
Have we done an episode on editorial cartoonists of the late 19th century, early 20th century?
I only know this because I happened to run across it. We did Thomas Nast.
Right.
Probably for Christmas.
But I don't believe we have really covered the fact that probably United States and British politics was influenced more by
100% shaped by
newspaper cartoonists than by any other single factor.
I mean, they did elaborate engraving and labeled 30 things.
Yeah.
And that's how people understood issues.
Avenge the Maine.
Exactly. So, well, remember the Maine, right?
Well, yeah, but that implies avenging it.
Yeah, you're not going to remember it just to like...
What are we remembering it for? To destroy the Spanish.
That's the only reason to remember it. Yeah. Remember the Alamo? Destroy the Spanish.
Yeah, right. Charge up San Juan Hill?
Via their Mexican descendants. So this picture of Teddy letting a bear cub go becomes really embedded in the popular imagination, even though it's a much cuter version of what actually happened.
And did Teddy go about any trouble to correct the mistake? Probably not.
No, he really embraced what happened next, which is we introduce Morris Mikdum, a Russian-born Jewish immigrant who's living in Brooklyn. He has opened a penny candy store in Bed-Stuy, and he and his wife, Rose, always looking for, you know, the next new thing, the next meme of the day that they can put in the window.
Total hipsters in Bed-Stuy.
They're like, where's Hawk to a girl? They realize that this Roosevelt not shooting the bear thing is catching on. And so they make a couple of little stuffed bears and put them in the window labeled Teddy's Bear.
Aww.
Just as kind of a topical come by our peppermint sticks.
They make them right there. Or she makes them, or they're made.
Yeah, it's always in the passive voice. And I, you know, maybe misogynistically assumed his wife would have done it, but apparently the two collaborated. And these are a huge hit in the neighborhood. People are not just coming in to buy candy. They want to buy the bears. And soon the victims cannot keep up with demand.
Now, is this because Bed-Stuy at the time...
I imagine it's a little different.
Was not a Republican stronghold, it was probably more the bear was cute.
Well, yeah, like this seems to be an idea, as we'll see in a moment, this seems to be an idea whose time has come, you know, that children do want cuddlier toys, and apparently he just nailed it, that this bear is pretty cute.
Cute.
At least by the lower cuteness bar then, they had not introduced big anime eyes and so forth.
I think that those are hideous. I think cuteness ended.
You think it's aliens colonizing us?
I do. I think they're getting us used to the idea that creatures with enormous eyes and disproportionately sized heads are just not only friendly, but like adorbs. And then they're going to take our blood.
So this bear does not stay a local Bed-Stuy phenomenon. In fact, Morris and Rose send one to the White House asking for permission to sell it as the Teddy Bear. And even though Roosevelt famously hates the nickname, he can't deny this new thought technology. He gives them permission to sell the teddy bear. And in fact, he kind of embraces it as a symbol of his reelection campaign because he now he's been delivered a mascot.
Sure, smart.
And all he had to do was not torture an animal. I wish I got a cool mascot every time I didn't torture an animal.
Yeah, but every day you don't torture an animal.
That's what I'm thinking. Like, I am constantly not torturing animals.
But then you would have an E.T. closet full of stuffed things.
Full of all my mascots.
I mean, we give out our address at the end of every episode. How many stuffed little turtles are you going to get? Mice.
I hope a lot.
Aww.
Yeah, now that you know I'm a mice guy. Mouse's name was Mortimer.
Your mouse.
Yeah, and I don't know if that came on the tag, because sometimes the name comes on the tag.
Right.
Or if that was a, you know, because Mickey Mouse's name was originally Mortimer, I think. So there's some cultural association of Mortimer.
But Mortimer was like a rat, right? Wasn't he at first
Well, he later becomes Mickey's kind of rat-like rival that's always showing him up by escorting Minnie around, I think. We're getting into some pretty deep lore here.
I would love to see, over the course of the next year, you get like 50 stuffed mice and then have to deal with it.
It was made, the reason why it deteriorated so quick is because it was made out of that weird kind of spongy stuff that stuffed animals were briefly made of, that's like...
like Nerf?
Yeah, it's like a Nerf-like foam, a very thin layer of it, and it did not hold up to the kind of the worrying between their fingers that kids do with their security
they're
blanket.
They're like little like rosary beads for children.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
That's kind of the same tendency, right?
Yeah, I think
Buddhists or Catholics, you want to have a reassuring thing. Today we just say it's
fiddle.
Neurodivergent people stimming, but I guess everybody wants it.
Well, yeah, they have now. They have little things that are literally called fidgets.
When you say now,
yes.
When do you think fidget spinners were popular?
Fidget spinners
like
are
a month ago.
Popular right now, aren't they? Well, when did fidget spinners arrive on the scene?
It's got to be almost 10 years at this point,
right? Is that right? Fidget spinners the whole time. Well, what about those little poppers?
Fidget spinners the whole time. Oh, I like those.
The little things where you pop it and then it's on the other side and you turn it over and pop it back.
I just my bedtime thing is one of those doctor's office things with the metal pegs that where you push it against your face and it makes a picture of your face.
Do you mess with one of those?
No. But wouldn't that, I do love those. Wouldn't that be a great bedtime toy?
Yeah, just like.
Oh, he fell asleep with it on his face again and you can see the kid's face is in the thing and he's drooling from behind it.
Well, you know, what I do because of the attention deficit disorder, I'm constantly going like this.
What are you doing, drumming?
Yeah,
just you're drumming your fingers.
Just drumming the fingers.
That's almost like a cartoon character I'm bored thing. I didn't know real people did that.
Oh, yeah. I'm always doing it. And then if you
Do you twiddle your thumbs?
No. Come on. I'm not 100 years old. I drum my fingers, and if you give me a television remote, any kind of remote control, I'll hold it in my hand and run my fingers over all the buttons.
Oh, me too.
So I start and I just...
I do my phone.
Screwing with the button, but your phone doesn't have buttons.
Well, I'm doing the same thing. I'm like, you know, I'm it's not on, but I'm like...
Oh, your side buttons.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, or whatever.
I mean, I don't want to use the term fingering, but it's the only way but you just sit and finger the buttons.
It's like a little masturbatory.
Finger. I mean, fingering isn't a word we use to describe masturbation.
Not if you're a man.
Right. Oh, that's right. That was gender specific.
I think you're right.
Diddle.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think, well, let's repurpose the word diddle to describe this process of sitting with the remote control and just diddling with it.
I find it's mostly I'm always twitching my leg. That's my...
Oh, your leg is bouncing?
That's my nervous energy. I'm a leg bouncer.
Do you think you have attention deficit disorder? Or are you just a fidgeter?
I don't think I have. I mean, I have... My executive function appears to be okay.
It does seem like you've written enough books that you complete tasks.
But I also do I'm always reading 6 books at once. Like, who knows anymore? Like, you know, we would have said Thomas Jefferson has a lively intelligence, and now we're like, nope.
Nope, it turns out. I mean, do you see what I'm doing right now? I do this all the time when we're...
I do fake typing.
Yeah, fake typing.
What else do I have?
We're both fidgeters, but right now I have my hands. How would you describe this? Like the same posture that if you're looking at your fingernails, all four of your fingernails, where you kind of put your
looking thumb at your manicure
and you're looking at your manicure and then turn that over and just kind of bounce them back and forth. Like boom, 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 boom.
You're some kind of little animal.
It's a little bit of a paw.
You're a lemur or something.
A little lemur.
Well, the story of Morris Mictum actually is that these teddy bears were a huge hit massively, nationally.
In Brooklyn.
Right. He founds a company with his family to make and sell them, and it goes on to become the ideal toy company. It doesn't become the ideal toy company. It becomes the capital I ideal toy company, which was the biggest maker of dolls for much of the 20th century.
Does that still exist, the ideal toy company?
They're big. Like, we don't remember Betsy Wetsy, maybe, but we do remember their...
Says you.
Their later... Soggy Doggy, Betsy Wetsy, Ithaca Kitty. We remember their big 80s hit. They brought the Rubik's Cube to America.
Oh, ideal toy company.
So this guy's little penny candy store in Brooklyn in 1902 turns into the Rubik's Cube. But here's the thing. So that's the teddy bear catching on, thanks to President Roosevelt.
Here's the thing. At 48 minutes.
We haven't even got to the there hasn't even been a shipwreck yet.
What is the thing?
People are like, when are we going to get to the fireworks factory? It becomes a huge fad nationwide with his bears. And for the first time, there is a canonical animal associated with this stuffed toy. And it starts to change kids.
It changes them.
Yeah, there's worry by moral scolds that it will change them. There's a Catholic priest in Michigan who predicts there will be falling birth rates. This must be an outgrowth of kind of contraception awareness.
Is he saying that?
Can you guess the mechanism?
Is he saying that people only have babies as kind of a fidget?
People
like, God, I'm bored.
People won't have sex anymore because there's a bear between them and their partner. No, the idea is that young girls will be playing with what he called a horrible monstrosity. It's the argument used today against how, Gen Z has dogs instead of
kids. Oh, babies. I see. She won't need a baby because
she's got her little teddy bear. So these cultural conservatives would see kids holding teddy bears more. We think, oh, how cute. This had never happened before, although it had to. Kids had dolls.
But this is also an era when... 13-year-olds were brides.
That's true.
So they're like, hey, this girl.
She should be married in 2 years. What's she doing with a bear? And that's kind of what happens. This is the beginning of kidulthood, a newer, more tolerant and longer view of childhood.
Did you set me up to now equate me, as you often do, with moral scolds of the 19th century?
You and that Catholic priest in Michigan.
Come on.
Cut
you
from
do this all
the same
time.
Cloth.
Lure me into having an opinion.
But the ship had long sailed, soldiers took their childhood did get longer. You know, teenagers now proudly had big stuffed animals on their beds. The girls had big stuffed animals on their beds. Even the boys, in World Wars I and II, soldiers took bears into the trenches or onto the islands with them. It's kind of the Brideshead Revisited trope of the kid at Oxford or Cambridge with his teddy bear as an affectation. That's what's going on here.
If I remember my early college days, it seemed very much that the girls in the dorms that had big bears on their beds, it was cuteness. They were advertising that they were cute and that they were tee-hee.
It's girlish, yeah.
And it was it was an affectation, at least as it seemed to me in 1987, that it was like, yeah, okay, you got a bear on your bed. Like,
well, I would say more charitably that a lot of these kids, whether they were GIs or Bobby Soxers, they also, like to snuggle up with their childhood bear at night because it helped them sleep.
Do you think that there is a size of bear where it's across a line? Because my teddy bear would fit in a shoebox.
Right. They used to be small.
It's this big. Yeah. My teddy bear is this big. It's the size of a loaf of bread. Now, when you have a bear that you want at the fair, a giant bear, you can't. Can you sleep with it? It's like the size of. I guess it's one of those pillows that you hug. It's like a huge thing.
You ever go to some really ostentatious toy store like FAO Schwartz before they moved in, and they've got these 12-foot tall stuffed giraffes
for rich dads,
for Silver Spoons kids.
Yeah, to apologize to their kid for never being home.
Sorry about the divorce, but what if you had a pinball machine?
But I have never once until today heard a justification for a stuffed animal as a sleep aid.
Oh, I assumed that was well understood to be the primary reason you have one.
No, I've
never. Because you don't take your teddy bear to the restaurant, but you do.
Well, you sure do take your teddy bear to the restaurant.
Today, even today, you would be a big oddity with a teddy bear at a restaurant, whereas...
Depending on your age.
If it's on your pillow at night, you'd be like, well, that's... Oh, I see what you're saying.
I mean
a teen or an adult.
I think of it as an anxiety soother, which I guess is connected to sleep, but...
It stays in the bed. It's bed bunny.
It is bed bunny.
I don't know.
Yeah, sleep... aid.
I mean, a lot of people do have their anxiety prop that they carry with them too, and that's getting more normalized. But I think
what helps you go to sleep, or do you and I just not sleep, and this is part of our?
I generally have slept pretty well, although I'm starting to wake up earlier with age. The last crutch I had that really worked well was I think I told you this: these little silicone earplugs.
Oh yeah,
they were doing construction on the house next door, and I started using these, and it was just like amazing. It was being in the womb.
Do you think that you sleep well partly because you stopped murdering people in the night?
I think it's never having murdered anyone. I am fairly clean of conscience. But I'm like anybody else. Like, it's all psychological. Like, even if I'm tired, if there's something in the news that I'm worried about, I'll be awake.
Is that right?
And if there's not, I'll be asleep.
You worry about the news a little.
Sure.
Somewhat.
Or any unresolved thing. You know, something I'm worried about with my kids.
Oh, yeah.
Or,
that's true.
You know, it's just something in the external world. Whatever in your life is unresolved when you go to bed, you might toss and turn. But maybe less if you have a teddy.
A little bougie.
Do you think you've come around to the idea that it might be a sleep thing?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm really, I think one of the things I'm going through right now culturally is just trying to decide whether, because for the last 15 years, soothing has become normalized for adults, and it's been perceived, I think, as part of a general rights movement, you know, against...
It's a mental health movement.
Yeah, against the old kind of, like, sort of, well, this transition from childhood to adulthood, like, as an adult, you shouldn't need a comfort animal on an airplane. And then, I mean, even the rise of comfort animals, it went through a phase where, I'm talking about now Twitter culture of the 2010s, it was a thing to be teased, and then gradually it was perceived as a rights question, and then it went through a phase where it was being abused, and then
that's lucky because you can tease it again.
Yeah, there was backlash against it, and then it was like, well, now like eliminating them is again a kind of discrimination, and now I don't know where we are on that because I'm not on Twitter anymore.
I think we might have landed on some. It's actually ableist to overexpand the definition of a...
Oh, right.
Because the people who actually need service animals are now getting side-eye because of all these goofy comfort turkeys on the plane.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's a limit to how many dogs you can have on the airplane, and so the anxiety dogs are bumping the actual seeing-eye dogs. And I don't know. I mean, I guess this falls into the, like, is... I mean, it doesn't fall into this, but, like, are furries...
You were a big furry defender. You were like, we don't make furry jokes.
At one level, I am a furry defender, but is furry enough of an identity that they belong in a separate class that has a
legal protections?
Yeah, legal protections. And, you know, is it a civil rights issue that furries can't go on airplanes dressed as giant cartoon mascots?
Well, I'm famously the libertarian on the show. You know, how I love libertarianism.
I do. You really are.
And I feel like this is the government should stay out of your bedroom.
Hey, all right.
Like
let's hear it.
The teddy bear on the bed hurts no one, right?
Well, I can't imagine a world in which the government would have an opinion about teddy bears, but, you know, we're living in weird times for sure.
So we got to get to the shipwreck, John. There hasn't been a single shipwreck on this show, and that makes for a dull omnibus.
No shipwrecks makes Jack a dull boy.
I would say the best omnibus entries have like multiple shipwrecks in the first 10 minutes.
We've definitely had a lot of shipwreck entries in the omnibus.
But we have not had one here. The twist here is that Morris Micton, the guy who founded the biggest doll company in America on the strength of the teddy bear,
turned out to be a serial killer.
Yes, he had killed 106 women.
He had
buried their bodies in the cellar by pretending to be Teddy Roosevelt.
No. Like those guys in Canada who he ground up all his victims and put them inside teddy bears.
No. That's a thing?
Well, no, those serial killers in Canada that owned a pig farm.
Oh, okay. I do remember that.
That was terrible business.
So despite that, he actually, Morris Micton, did not make the first stuffed bear. He thought he had.
He stole the bear? Oh, he didn't steal the bear.
So this is a case of simultaneous pollination. You know, new upholstery technologies and new views of childhood and cuteness meant several months before Morris Micton hit it big with his Teddy Roosevelt-themed bear, we got to go back to Gingen, Germany, on the borders between Baden-Württemberg and Bavaria.
I don't want to go back to Gingen, Germany.
No, you do, because it's got your friend Margarete Steiff, world's greatest polio-stricken seamstress.
It's true. I do love Margarete.
And it turns out that her nephew, Richard, has taken over some of the family's factory business. And Ricard is a fan of the bear.
Oh, more than the elephant.
He goes to Stuttgart Zoo often where, apparently, and this is just a side note in a lot of these accounts that should be its own story, where they have been interbreeding brown and polar bears.
What?
What is, why is the Stuttgart... Even before the war, the Germans are creepy eugenicists.
I didn't think that you could breed a... I mean, I guess there's no reason... I feel like if
there's
if
no you law could, saying a dog can't play basketball.
If you could breed polar bears and brown bears, why haven't we been doing it whole time?
Where are the brawler bears at? Anyway, he's very interested in the cute results of this breeding operation at the Stuttgart Zoo lab.
How cute.
And he, in the company later, the company's later accounts, is just fed up with kids just having pokey, stiff toys and thinks they should have something soft and cuddly.
Okay.
His mom or his aunt has had a hit with that elephant pincushion.
Yep.
And so he designs a bear. And he does so months before Morris Mictum sees the Berryman cartoon and designs his own bear.
And, of course, the bear is a frequent icon. It's a frequent graphical thing in Germany.
It's
the symbol of Berlin and Bavaria.
Bear in Switzerland, which is mm-hmm. quasi-Germanic,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he thinks a bear is the way to go. He designs one that a model that is now called 55PB. It's not an adorable name. It's more like a droid, but it's 55 centimeters tall, which is almost 2 feet. It's a surprisingly big teddy bear. The P is for plush, or however you say plush in German, plush. And the B is beweglich. It's movable. Its arms and legs are cut on little strings, so you can pose it, which is a new innovation. And he thinks this would be a delightful companion for a young child. And remember, the teddy bear doesn't exist. He's doing this in a vacuum where there is no Paddington or Winnie the Pooh. These are all results of his and Mictum's work and not cause. I don't even know. Is there a sense of a bear being a cute children's character at this time? Do Grimm's fairy tales have cute bears? No, right?
No.
The bear is like the wolf. It's a bit of a noble creature of the wild, but if anything, it's a menace, right? It's not a companion.
Can I think of any instance of a bear as like a familiar or a selkie or something where it's like a bear is a friend?
I guess the movie Brave, but that came out in around 2006.
Maybe? No, it's an emblem of ferocity.
Yeah, it's heraldic. Yeah. It's military. People exit pursued by a bear in Shakespeare. Anyway.
Apparently, grizzly bears and polar bears are called growlars or pizzlies. I liked yours better. What was yours called?
Well, I said brawler because it was a brown bear.
Yeah, brawler. But pizzlies and growlers, and when they grow up, sometimes they're blue.
What?
Yeah. I mean, silver blue.
Not Smurf blue. But anyway, so Ricard Steiff thinks this is the way forward for the family company. He takes a bunch of them to the Leipzig Toy Fair in 1903, unaware that at virtually the same time, its bears are starting to appear in candy store windows in Brooklyn.
But they're not making it all the way to Leipzig at this point. American
bears. Right. This is by sheer coincidence. And apparently it's a terrible trade fair. Nobody is interested in buying 55PB, what would be a groundbreaking idea that you're kid could have a cute, cuddly bear cub as a companion.
Maybe they're also against the infantilization of
that's probably it.
Their youth.
Or they haven't been spending enough time at the Stuttgart Zoo. But at the same time at the fair, an American, Hermann Berg, I think he must be an Austrian-American because I believe he is actually the brother of composer Alban Berg, the great Viennese composer of the period. He is a buyer for the Borgfeldt department store in New York City, and he has also had a terrible fair. He's been trudging around with instructions from his boss to find the next big thing, and he does not see it. And
he's like, tin soldiers, more tin soldiers. This German toy fair sucks.
Why tin soldiers? Why do they have all these Prussian military toys? What could that say about the coming century? But on the last day of the fair, the story goes, he walks up to the Steiff booth right as Ricard is sadly packing up his last box of unbought FFPBs and is sealing it up. And he says, well, what were you selling? And he's like, well, I'm heading out. I'm just got the last box out, onto the cart, and he says, well, what's in the box? And he reopens it and takes out F55PB. And Hermann Berg thinks, this is it.
This is it.
This is it. And on the spot.
Might not sell in Germany, but in sweet old New York town.
Your kids are going to love it. I don't believe he knows about the teddy bear either.
Mm-hmm.
He buys 3,000 of them on the spot.
Holy.
Single-handedly saving the Steiff company, kind of converting them into a stuffed animal company. They build a new factory to process this huge order.
What the what?
Now, the Steiff factory is still in Gingen, Germany. I know this because it was a big part of my wife's childhood. Her dad worked for the government in Germany. She grew up there. And it was a big part of family trips that every time they were through that part of Germany, they would stop in Gingen and go to the Steiff factory store where you could buy, you know, they had a very high quality control standard, which is why they're still made there after an unsuccessful flirtation with China. And they would have, you know, a monkey with a slightly asymmetrical smile or a penguin whose heart had been spray painted on a little bit wrong. And they would have these amazing
like seconds,
toys for
you're saying.
Yeah. And they would still look amazing to our eyes because this was an exacting company. And so Mindy's childhood closet was full of these super high-end, because Steiff, those are expensive toys. Like, yeah. This is a collector's teddy bear.
Well, how cute.
And they were famous for their teddy bears at the time. Mindy's dad was the commercial attaché, so he could call ahead and be like,
do you know who I am?
Well,
I don't know. He's an American.
I don't know why he would have a German. Do you know who I am?
Hey, boy, I'm from America.
I'm Mike TV. No, his office would call and be like, the head commercial attaché would like to tour. And they'd be like, yes, sir.
Oh, because he's a commercial attaché.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big deal. So they would roll out the red carpet and they'd get a tour and they'd get free stuff.
You want to sell these bears in America, you're going to have me over.
And so we actually went there. I was in Germany once with Mindy and the kids. And just for nostalgia's sake, we hooked up with her parents and went to the Gingen. You can still buy stuff there. There's a little museum with their history. But you cannot buy cheap factory seconds anymore, it turns out. But one thing you learn in the museum is that none of those bears survived. There's now a huge collector's market for
the 3,000 bears
for Steiff antiques. You know, some of their teddy bears go for well over $100,000 if you have the right one.
You do not.
But there is not a single surviving 55 PB.
No,
the teddy bear.
And, I can only guess why.
Well, I've kind of given it away. The museum will tell you the corporate story, which is that the shipment to the States never arrived due to a tragic loss at sea, and that 3,000 of the 55 PBs are at the bottom of the Atlantic, never having to made it to Borgfeldt shoppers and grinning American children.
I'm agape.
Which means if we could find that trove...
Do you think that
there could be $30 million in teddy bears at the bottom of the Atlantic?
It's an anoxic environment, and the bears have survived like unscathed.
My guess is they were not packaged super airtight.
Yeah.
Well, it's a wonderful story. I think modern day investigation has revealed that there probably was no teddy bear shipwreck. I hate to debunk it just minutes after first mentioning it.
What happened to the 3,000 bears?
That's the question. The story of the shipwreck can only be traced back to a 1953 Steiff Company brochure.
There's no record of it in its time.
Right. It's a 50th anniversary retelling of the event for children. And it says the bears were lost at sea. There doesn't seem to be any contemporary evidence. We do know that the bears were made.
Yeah.
All 3,000 existed. We have templates. We have patterns. We even have samples of the boxes in which they were packed. So we know they were shipped.
But if bears of this type are worth $200,000, and
more,
these bears
sure.
more,
yeah.
Why has not one appeared?
The modern conjecture seems to be that they just did not survive because, unlike later Steiff toys, they were not very well made.
3,000 bears and not one of them in a footlocker or in the top of an attic or something?
Well, think about it. This is 1903. So you've got decades for... That's what you imagine. Well, they're sitting in an attic. But you have decades for them to be played with without any conception that they're anything more than disposable children's toys before any kind of nostalgia, much less collector's mentality, begins to grow up around them.
But doesn't Antiques Roadshow tell us that every single piece of junk is going to have at least one survive?
I mean, we know about the cases that they do, but that could just be, what do you call it? What's the survivor's fallacy or whatever?
Yeah,
like,
right.
We never, the things that would be worth millions but did not survive,
we don't know about.
They rarely show up on Antiques Roadshow.
But
for
in
obvious
this,
reasons.
Because Steiff keeps records.
Yeah, the problem, I think, is the B in Beweglich in 55PB. The dolls were posable, but that meant the limbs were just kind of tied on with strings.
Oh, I see.
So the limbs kind of flopped. And
the problem is always the bee in Beweglich.
nothing rains on a teddy bear picnic faster than Beweglich. So I think what would happen is the arms and legs would fall off, and at that point, you know, maybe the kid cries and begs for the bear to be repaired, but
Bed Bunny number 4 arrives.
Yeah, it becomes the case where the kids can tell, oh, this is not my cute bear anymore. Now, scour your attics. Mm-hmm. There probably is a $1 million teddy bear somewhere. I guess Steiff has been brought examples of like the 1904 bears that look very similar. So do not be fooled. These are dark in color. They're not that cute compared to modern teddy bears, and they don't have the button in the ear. Apparently, the Steiff button placed in the ear was only in the 1904 model. So if you can find a buttonless, darker colored, slightly off model looking Steiff teddy bear, it might be worth, it's priceless. It'd be the one of its kind. It might be worth millions of dollars to
but
a collector.
Wouldn't it also, wouldn't the Steiff company be super bummed that their whole story about teddy bear shipwreck is debunked? Or maybe one washed up on the shore in France, like all those Garfield clocks or whatever?
It's like, I can imagine a montage of it just floating across the Atlantic for decades, having various adventures. At one point, it gets swallowed by a shark.
Yeah.
Fisherman cuts it open, catches it, gets caught in a net.
This children's book writes itself.
So the teddy bear shipwreck that I promised probably never happened.
Oh.
But that's just a hopeful sign that maybe a 55 PB is out there somewhere.
So who cornered the teddy bear market when all of a sudden teddy bears were like the thing? Was it just everybody jumped in and there was no, even if you patented it, it didn't?
Well, Steiff became synonymous with teddy bears. They kept at it.
Even more than the Ideal toy company.
Yeah, I think in the U.S., you know, Ideal was out of the gate first, but they later became more of a doll company, whereas Steiff stayed in the stuffed animal market. And so, you know, lots of German and European kids grew up, you know, the affluent ones grew up with high-end stuffed Steiff, everything. Here's my monkey, here's my lion, here's my doggy.
Well, see, now this is my point.
Here's my teddy bear.
Because, you know, you want to think like, oh, well, the teddy bears and this culture, you know, makes you a kinder, gentler nation, but that didn't keep them from invading Poland.
Maybe they just needed more. Maybe if they had 3,000 more 55 PBs, Hitler would have been like, ach, now I can sleep at night.
And that concludes the Teddy Bear Shipwreck. Entry 1283.PR2433. Certificate number 24398. In the omnibus.
Are you really going to do it like that?
That's how it got done. Futurelings, social media is no good. No good at all. But you can go to Facebook and Instagram and look at Omnibus Project and at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick and see things.
At least Facebook has the Futurelings. That's a nice place on Facebook.
Facebook has the Futurelings. I think there are Futurelings congregating on Reddit and Discord and other places. You know, Snapchat, I don't think people congregate. They just go independently and send booby shots to one another, and then it all disappears, right?
It's just like the teddy bears.
TikTok, I wonder, are there Futurelings on TikTok that are like dancing to the sound of you and me talking about ancient Phoenicia?
I hope not.
That seems like a weird thing, but maybe.
That's why Biden banned TikTok, to keep that from happening.
Yeah, darn TikTok.
I thought you were going to say Biden. It was a real roller coaster.
No, no. John supports President Biden. Good Democratic president. Yes, 10 stars.
An old Irish Catholic guy should always be president.
You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. One thing you could email us about is you could yell at me about how bummer I am about being youthful.
What about whimsy, John?
Yeah,
what about my inner child?
And also all of my neurodivergence requires these things, and you are against people and bad.
If you don't think I should have 800 Funko Pops, you are the Gestapo. Unwoke.
Yes, you are bad, and I'm going to cancel you along with my Funko Pop friends. You should email theomnibusproject@gmail.com about that. And then Ken and Mindy will not show it to me, and I'll be blissfully unaware, and all your work would be for naught.
I could send it to you.
Because Ken and Mindy don't care about you being mad at me, which is part of a wonderful part of our friendship.
I mean, we don't care in the sense that we kind of like it.
Yeah,
it doesn't trouble us.
You guys can soak it up, and then you're like, why bother sending this to John? It'll just make him hard to work with. You can go on the Facebook group, Omnibus Futurelings. Don't talk about what a bad guy I am on there, because every once in a while Ken will show up and very sarcastically reply to your posts.
Do you not go there anymore? I never see you post there anymore.
My Facebook algorithm only wants to show me videos of like cow farriers, like trimming cow hooves.
So it's accurate.
The
Facebook algorithm works for you.
It understands that what it shows me is people trimming cow hooves that have infections, right? It's not like, hey, let's just trim this healthy hoof. It's always like, this cow is limping. Let's find out why.
And I don't want infections in my so satisfying video feed.
No, it always involves, and the thing is, I don't get Dr. Pimple Popper or anything like that. I just watched one of these videos once, and now it's like, dude loves an infected hoof. And then it also wants to show me baseball highlights and Simpsons. Seinfeld bloopers. And that's pretty much it. So I don't see Futurelings anymore. I don't see my own, you know, Gary's Van is like a Roderick on the Line fan base.
Well, you could make that the URL you went to and just be like, hey, what's going on at Gary's Van? Hey, what's going on at the Futurelings?
I didn't know that.
You don't have to just wait for the feed to throw things at you.
Oh, really? I don't know how that you're doing the thing that you're talking about. You can have their own URLs?
Facebook.com/group/Futurelings. Avoid the algorithm.
Oh, wow. I'll do that. I never heard of that before.
Oh, you're going to be posting all the time now. This is great.
Futurelings.com/Facebook.
No,
Facebook.
No, yeah. That's it, Grandma. Go to futurelings.com/Facebook. Go to the Google.com. Do you know they have the Google on your phone now? /groups/Futurelings.
Oh, why is it all in caps? /groups/Futurelings? And it takes me to, wait a minute, playboy.com.
Gotcha.
There it is. It says, here's the first thing. Mike D'Angelo says, it quotes me saying, this is now King Kamehameha 4. And you say, the voyage home. And then, of course, somebody's yelling that I didn't acknowledge your gag.
That's what this page is.
Yeah,
people appreciating my gags and getting angered up that you didn't.
It's all people like, Ken made another pun, and John just didn't even hear it. Didn't even understand.
I like that you created a thread for them, but they're still sneaking out.
I did. I made a thread that was like, if I don't get one of Ken's jokes, you think, post here. And they're just like, no, this is one of our things that we do.
We need a new post every week for this.
All right. Well, I guess I would bookmark that if I knew how to do that. You can mail us things, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Do not mail us your stuffed animal unless it is a Steifbear without a button in its ear.
Send us 55 PB. We'll give it to the Smithsonian.
But otherwise, like your old tattered stuffed animals, we won't know what to do with them. We don't have any connection to them. And the last thing, we would respectfully bring your attention to the Omnibus Patreon at patreon.com/omnibus. Your generous contributions fuel the show. Without your generous contributions, Ken and Mindy would start sending me your angry mail just to exacerbate.
No, the mail would stop coming because we would stop doing the show.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So don't do that. Let us keep doing the show. It's good for us both. It keeps us off the streets.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Of the many things we hope and pray will never come, the catastrophe we fear leads the list. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, We hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.